Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 19th of November. The central organizing idea of the book that we are about to talk about and this hour of conversation with the author, War is Hell, Decent Men and Women Are Often Called to Fight It, and Their Story is Intrinsically Worth Telling. David Finkel is our guest this hour. He is the author of The Good Soldiers. David is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The Washington Post and is joining us from the studios of The Post this morning. He was awarded the 2006 Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting for his series of stories about U.S.-funded democracy efforts in Yemen. And between January of 2006 and June of 2008, he spent 8 months with a battalion of 800 United States Army soldiers from Fort Riley, Kansas, known as the 216. And by the end of their 15-month deployment, 14 soldiers would be dead. Another 75 would receive the Purple Heart. The average age of the boys, which is so hard to fathom, 19 years old. And David is with us this hour, and we're welcoming phone calls for him. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address, if you'd like to use that, talk@WPR.org. Hello, David. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Good morning.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Are you ever a writer? Whew.
Well, you really are.
You're just so good. It's one of those books that's kind of for all time. I'm sure reviewers have seen it that way, and they have, that it is about Iraq, but it's also about a pretty deep understanding of what most of us hopefully will never have to experience, which is the experience of war, right?
Well, that was the intent anyway. Just one quick correction, if I may. I first met the battalion I wrote about in January 2007, not 2006. It was just as they were about to deploy from Fort Riley, Kansas, to what was supposed to be a 12-month deployment in Iraq and ended up being a 15-month deployment.
Mm-hmm.
They were on the ground in Baghdad probably a little under 14 months. I was there for about 8 of those months. And the book is the idea of the book was to go along to chronicle what happened to them during their deployment without any agenda, see who they were, what happened, and who they became.
And so many of them, 19 years old, just kids, David, just kids.
Well, that's exactly right. I'm a 50-year-old man. These soldiers are younger, the average age younger than both of my children.
Hmm.
There were a couple of guys, 17 years old, and they were almost to a man, so optimistic when they went into the surge and less so when they came home.
Mm-hmm. And talking about optimism, you paint this very full, intricate portrait of the Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Kozlerich, who mm-hmm. also is sort of the epitome of optimism. It's all good. It's all good. Everything's all good. Who commands a great deal of respect from the people he's leading.
Well, that went up and down, I think, depending on how tired and how hurt mentally and physically the soldiers became. There were periods when they would begin calling Kozlerich the lost cause.
Mm-hmm.
Some other guys were referring to him at various points as President Bush as a way to register their disappointment with what was going on. But through it all, my impression of watching Kozlerich is he was almost ceaselessly optimistic, a brilliant tactical soldier, and did the best he could and probably did things in a very bad area of Baghdad that kept more of his men alive than might be expected in such a place at such a time.
Yeah, tell us about the area of Baghdad. It wasn't where politicians go.
No, I'm glad you asked. By the luck of the draw, this battalion, as you said, 800 soldiers, average age 19, most on their first deployment. As late as December 2006, they thought, even though they had been trained to be an infantry battalion, they thought they were going to go into western Iraq to do convoy protection, supply convoys. And then on January 10th, when President Bush announced the surge, they found out a couple days later that their mission had changed, that they would be a fighting battalion on the ground in the surge, and instead of western Iraq, they ended up in eastern Baghdad in an area that turned out to be especially vicious.
And the lieutenant colonel we mentioned before had never, I think this is true, had never lost anybody under his command. And early on, he has to face a casualty. And these young people have to as well.
Right. If you know, if Kathleen, if it's fair to say this, if you, I mean, we've reached the point now, I think to most Americans, the Iraq War seems pretty much over. I mean, and we
yes.
can talk about whether that's true. But nonetheless, there's a perception that the surge worked, things have calmed down, and the war's about over. Whether that's true or not, in January 2007, when Bush announced the surge, it was entirely the opposite. The war really did seem to have arrived at the lost moment. And beyond that moment, it seemed that there was a sense that tragedy was at hand. That's a very interesting moment for a writer, for a reporter. And so that's why I decided to try to write a chronicle of what the soldiers went through. And again, the other thing to remind listeners about 2007, if they followed the literature of the war, the great policy books about the war had been done, memoirs were coming out, but there hadn't yet been a third-person account at the far end of strategy and politics, which is the war itself fought by the soldiers. So that was the idea going into it. And again, by the luck of the draw, they ended up in a tough area in East Baghdad. They probably spent the first month or so thinking they were pretty invincible until they had their first casualty. And then the casualties kept coming, and the 19-year-olds became 20, and they became 21.
Hmm.
And they were changed.
Mm-hmm. And it's so sad. Well, the whole thing is so poignant. But at the end, when they're just about to come home, then really all hell breaks loose for them.
Well, you're talking about a time after they had reached the end of their deployment and things in their part of Baghdad had quieted down pretty much. And again, to a man, they were thinking that they had had an effect. As they were packing up to go home, their job done, with no expectation other than to spend a few days packing everything that has to be packed to move a battalion back home to Fort Riley, the place they were in suddenly exploded into such thorough, nonstop warfare that instead of packing up, these guys spent the last week, week and a half of their deployment in a flat-out fighting war.
Mm.
And the very people they had done so much to try to protect seemed to have turned on them just in an instant. And some people came home still thinking they had achieved what they set out to do, but many more soldiers came home really confused by what the whole thing had become.
And the people they had tried to protect turned on them for what reason?
Well, they all didn't turn on them, but a lot seemed to have. And what happened, again, it's we have to go back in time. But in late March 2008, the Prime Minister of Iraq thought the moment had been reached where he could take his own troops into the southern city of Basra, which was quite restive, and try to bring it under control. And there were plenty of stories at that time about what happened when those troops went into Basra. The mass defections, the number of civilians being killed. What wasn't reported is what happened in East Baghdad. But basically the effect of Basra immediately shivered its way north, right into where these guys were. And all the people who had been hiding inside, basically living under a ceasefire, this is getting a little confused, but there had been a ceasefire in effect. The ceasefire was lifted, war began, and these soldiers just found themselves in the middle of it was really, honest to God, nonstop, frightening war.
Mm. How did the – and you write so movingly about how the soldiers deal with their fear. I mean, they start – you start with their writing their – how their funerals are going to be and what their wills are, what you have to do before you go to a place like Iraq. For 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds to be thinking about that is quite something. Do you stuff it inside in some place? Because you talk about their knees wobbling as they're taking a tour of
right.
where they're going to be. I don't know how you deal with that kind of fear.
Well, it was the weapon of choice where they were in eastern Baghdad. It wasn't suicide bombers necessarily. There were one or two during their time there. It wasn't so much snipers, although there were snipers. It was a particularly insidious type of roadside bomb called an EFP, which stands for Explosively Formed Penetrator. But if I can take a minute to describe what that was, it was basically a dinner-sized plate, it was a piece of copper about the same size as a dinner plate, that had been milled into a slightly concave shape and stuck at the end of a tube of explosives. And what would happen is somebody would stand far away in the shadows of eastern Baghdad, and when a convoy of soldiers reached the right point, he would press a button. The explosives would explode, and the copper disc would go forward at such velocity that almost instantly it would become semi-molten. It almost assumed a tadpole sluggish type shape. And it would simply burn through whatever was in front of it. These EFPs cost perhaps $100 to make. And against them, a $200,000 Humvee with the very thickest armored door possible didn't stand a chance. The EFP slug would go through the Humvee, and if there were soldiers inside in the way, it would go through them as well. So as these things kept going off, the thing that made them worse and more insidious, I guess, is that they could be hidden anywhere. And they were. They were hidden in animal carcasses. They were hidden. They were disguised as pieces of curbing in the road. They were hidden in trash piles. And I can tell you that pretty much all of eastern Baghdad was a trash pile. So they could be anywhere, and they were anywhere. And so what you would see these young soldiers do was to make the most heartbreaking calculations as they got in a convoy to go out once again into this area seated with EFPs. They would tie a horseshoe to the front of their Humvee. They would kind of joke about what their last words ought to be. They would get inside the Humvee, and some soldiers would sit with one foot in front of another, so if the EFP came in, they would lose one foot day instead of two. They would ride with their hands tucked behind their ceramic plates or lean away from the door a little bit. Whatever they could do to withstand what might happen when an EFP came inside and burned whatever was in its way.
And you had, tell me, you had an encounter with one of these, or was it something else where you kind of proved that you were tough, okay, that you were okay because you didn't flinch, I read somewhere.
Yeah, well, I don't think anybody spending time over there can get away with not being in the middle of something. So there were, there were occasions when I was in convoys that were hit by EFPs. And I think the fact that when that happened, I didn't become a problem for the soldiers. I didn't wig out. I just kept acting as a journalist, taking notes. I think it helped my credibility with the soldiers because when this began, these guys didn't really know why a journalist was in their midst and was going to stay in their midst. And I think a lot of them were suspicious of my motives. But the longer I stayed and the more I went through and didn't run off and didn't become a problem, over time, soldiers began seeking me out to talk about what was really on their mind, which is ultimately reflected in the book.
Right, which was what the book is. What was your heart doing when you experienced that? Did you have a few flutters?
Well, it's... yes, but I want to emphasize something that I was quite fortunate in that if I didn't want to go out one day in a convoy, I could choose not to go out. And after 4 weeks or 6 weeks or 8 weeks, when I would get pretty cooked from all that was going on and needed a break, I could get on a helicopter, leave the base I was on, go to the Green Zone, go to the Washington Post Baghdad Bureau, spend a few days there getting some sleep, not worrying about rocket attacks, having a drink, and then go back to it. Or I could come back to the States and do some reporting here and take a break. And I bring this up because the soldiers didn't have that luxury. They had to go out every day. They got 18 days to come home and visit their families. But other than that, that was it. They were in the midst of it by choice because they did enlist in the Army and enthusiastically some days. But as the injuries went on, it changed. Yet they didn't have a choice. They kept going out. And it did reach the point, Kathleen, where toward the end, on days when I wouldn't go out, when I would not, and I would line up and watch the convoys go away another day. The simple act of these soldiers going out yet again into this area was about the bravest thing I'd ever seen.
And yet the mental wreckage, you write, is astounding. You talk about many of the soldiers. Sergeant Adam Schumann spent over 1,000 days in the country. Couldn't shake images like that of a man he'd shot sinking into the mud as he died. The images that these young people have seen, no wonder they reach a breaking point. Their minds and hearts are broken.
Well, if I can tell you about Adam Schumann for a minute, anybody who questions the will of soldiers ought to meet Adam Schumann. But he was widely acknowledged to be one of the very best soldiers in this battalion. He was not 19. He was in his mid-20s. He was on his third deployment in Iraq. He had been in country for about 1,000 days. And very early in the deployment, about maybe 6 weeks after they arrived, there was a mission in which a guy named Michael Emery was on the rooftop, and he was shot in the back of the head. And it was quite a serious wound. Down he went onto the rooftop. They needed to get him downstairs from this building to get him in a Humvee to go to an aid station. They were having a difficult time navigating the stairs, so Adam Schumann threw Michael Emery across his back and took him downstairs. It just so happened that the angle that Michael Emery was at meant that all the blood from his wound kept going into Adam Schumann's mouth. Spit out the blood as he was carrying this man downstairs. And 6 months later, he was still tasting the blood. And that was just one of many, many things where he realized the time had come. He couldn't do this anymore. And overcome with a lot of guilt, he left Iraq. And I was with him the day he left. And it's something I think about quite often because I'm still in contact. I talk to Adam quite a lot. The day he left, he said goodbye to his soldiers. Walked by himself to the area where the helicopters landed so he could go away. And he joined a line of other soldiers waiting for a helicopter. In comes the helicopter. The line moves forward, and when it comes time for Adam Schumann to get on board, a hand comes down and a guy says, "This isn't your helicopter." And Adam didn't quite understand what that meant. Everyone leaves. Another helicopter comes in, this one with the big red cross on the side, and it's the helicopter for the wounded and the dead. And it was the helicopter that took Adam Schumann away from that war and into the war he continues to fight back home in Kansas.
Oh, my gosh. What a story that is. Ooh, that'll enter my dreams tonight, I think. It's something. Let's welcome phone calls for our guest. David Finkel is with us, and David is the author of The Good Soldiers. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 2006 for explanatory reporting. This book is about the 8 months he spent with a battalion of 800 U.S. Army soldiers from Fort Riley, Kansas, known as the 216. It was a campaign known as the Surge, announced by President Bush on January 10th of 2007, which you'll recall sent an additional 21,000 troops into Iraq to quell sectarian violence in hopes that some reconciliation may take place. And the book is, well, it's about a lot of things. It's about the service of these unbelievable young people who, as he said, struggle to be decent in a terrifying environment. It's kind of your ultimate war book, what it means to be there. Join us if you'd like. We'd like very much to hear from you. I'm sure that some of you listening many of you listening have served in war and can identify with what it is David is saying. Some of you listening have served in Iraq. We've heard from you, or in Afghanistan. The experience, your experience, we'd like to hear as well. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that at talk. So what is it? Talk@WPR.org. Talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I do want to remind you that To the Best of Our Knowledge is doing a series on Iraq and Soldiers in Iraq, Boots on the Ground is the name of it, and you can hear that again on Sunday at 12 o'clock noon. David Finkel is our guest now. His book is The Good Soldiers, and we're welcoming phone calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, for you to join the conversation. You talk about these people who have three tours of duty, 1,000 days, some are doing more than that. It seems as though one of the things that we could ask of our government is to not have people have to go through that much terror.
Yeah, but what are the alternatives? These wars, they've been declared, they're underway, manned, and so... So if you're in charge of things, I'm not quite sure how you arrange a flow chart to keep folks out of it. I'm stumbling a bit because the book, the journalism I've done was not any attempt to second guess the strategy or the politics that had led to the moment of the surge.
Mm-hmm.
And that when I went over there, there was actually one promise made from each side. I promised Koslerich, the battalion commander, that I was coming over there with absolutely no agenda. I wasn't trying to write a book that said war is good, war is bad, the surge worked, the surge didn't work. It really was to just try to intimately chronicle what happened to him and his soldiers. And in return, his promise was, well, if you want to come over and if you want to stay here, we'll give you full access to everything we're doing. And he honored his word. So the book is based on almost entirely on observed reporting. The things that are in the book are an honest account of what happened. I didn't sit in on the strategy sessions back in Washington. I didn't sit on political meetings. And so I'm uncomfortable second-guessing any of that because, except as the soldiers themselves would second-guess it, because I only saw what I saw.
Right. But what you saw were people recounting incidents of absolute horror that it seems to me would haunt people for a long period of time because they've been stretched to the limit. I'm wondering how often you heard from the soldiers or how common the story was that you just told us that you reach a breaking point. You've seen so much that you just can't see anymore.
One of the things that's happened since the book has come out, I've been hearing from a lot of the soldiers, both families of soldiers who died and a lot of the soldiers themselves who survived and didn't suffer any physical scars. The mental scars go deep, and they're not in every soldier. I think that would be an overstatement. Most would probably tell you they're doing okay, but there's a fair number, and to me, a disturbing number of soldiers who are having a very difficult time adjusting. I found when I would come back to the States and go to hospitals and see how wounded soldiers were doing, the physical care offered by the Army was extraordinary. I can't imagine better care. But the mental care, there's a big question, and I think the Army itself is trying to come to terms with this. Peter Corelli talks a lot about being very concerned about the high suicide rate. He's made a lot of interesting public comments about the need to take on PTSD as an issue. I'm not sure how far and how fast that's going to trickle down because my time there and my emails from the soldiers since suggest that a lot of guys are having a hard time and they're not getting the help they need. And
yeah.
One of them includes Adam Schumann.
Let's go to some phone calls. Dr. Brian from Pewaukee. Hi.
Yes, good morning, Kathleen. Good morning, Dave. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Good. I'm a provider, and I just this morning had managed a very young man who had to exit Iraq in 2006. And he's currently managing a very significant psychological as well as physical injury. The fact is that this is happening right here in Wisconsin. And I can't imagine except that they're not telling us everything that happened, and I want to thank you for following them. You were in bed, correct?
Yes.
Yes. I want to thank you for sharing your story because otherwise we're not hearing it from them. They're, for whatever good reason, until they are able, they're experiencing understandable difficulty expressing what it is that they suffered. So thank you for helping us to open up.
Well, thanks for the comment. And I have to tell you that if there's a common thread to the emails from soldiers, beyond the ones that are relating their own personal stories and asking for some guidance, actually, if there's a common theme to the emails, it's that I came back, a soldier would say, everyone would say, what was it like? I didn't want to talk about it. I don't want to talk about it. I don't know how to talk about it. Now I can hand over the book and say, read the book, and you'll understand a little of what happened, and you'll also understand why I don't want to talk about it. So those are good emails to get, that somehow the book, the stories, are helping not soldiers talk anymore, but families and loved ones understand a little bit more of what they went through and why it's so difficult to talk.
And I think it goes beyond Iraq and the wars that we're fighting now. It's what all people, I think, go through during war. I think that's one of the remarkable things about your book.
Oh, my heavens. I would think that, I mean, I just happened to concentrate on a battalion called
right.
the 216, but it could have been any battalion during the surge. It could have been any battalion in any of the versions of war preceding the surge,
mm-hmm.
or in any other war at any time.
Right.
It's not news that war is bad, but
mm-hmm.
it seems to me that there's value in getting the details down as part of the record of what a war is.
Mm-hmm.
And so two effects, maybe. One is it's helping soldiers talk a little bit more, families to understand a little bit more. The other value might be to a reader who opens the paper and sees that the count of the dead has surpassed 4,000, or sees that in eastern Baghdad, or now Afghanistan, a roadside bomb went off and two soldiers died. That's not quite enough to know when you're evaluating what this war is all about. It's better to know what really happens when that bomb goes off and the soldiers go on past it.
Yeah. Tell us the story. I was really struck by these planning their funerals at the beginning of the book. The story of Duncan Crookston, who you
yeah.
write about in his little apartment with his mom and dad and his
mm-hmm.
new 19-year-old wife packing his things. He had just planned his funeral.
Right. Duncan is, it's a great family, the Crookston family. And when we first meet Duncan in the book, he's preparing to go. He's packing up his little garage and his stuff. And he gets a phone call where he just basically answers, what song he wants and maybe an inscription on his headstone. And he hangs up and he says to his family, well, I just planned my funeral.
Hmm.
So what happens is, on September 4th, 2007, and this is the day, it just so happens that President Bush lands in Australia and is overheard on the tarmac at the airport saying to a deputy prime minister who had asked him how the war is going, we're kicking ass. Also on September 4th, in eastern Baghdad, Duncan Crookston and four other soldiers get in a Humvee, and they're out on a road called Route Predators. An EFP explodes. Three soldiers die, a fourth loses both of his legs, and then there's Duncan Crookston, who loses both legs all the way up. He loses his right arm at the shoulder, and he loses most of his left arm. And what's left of Duncan is very badly burned, but he doesn't die. He's airlifted out to Landstuhl and then back to Brooke Army Medical Center outside of San Antonio. And the months go by, and Duncan doesn't die. He undergoes 30 surgeries. At one point, what's left of his eyes are sutured shut. His ears fall off. His nose falls off. He can't move, of course, because there's so little of him left. And he's basically bandaged and bolted to a bed. And he's wearing these self-misting goggles because his eyes can no longer produce moisture. And so whatever happens to come into Duncan's room at the hospital is almost like swimming through droplets of water. And one day into the room comes Ralph Koslerich, the commander of the battalion, who's been home on leave. And at the end of his leave, he decides to go see his wounded soldiers. And Ralph has this it's almost like a mantra where every day he would say the phrase, it's all good, about something or other. But when he went into Duncan's room, you know, that's the day he didn't say it. He just kind of swore a little bit under his breath, went over, spent some time with Duncan talking to him and his family, left Brooke Army Medical Center, got on a plane to go back to Iraq, landed, went to his office, turned on his computer, and there was an email waiting from Duncan's mother that said he had just died. So Duncan made it for a while, and then he didn't, and he became the 12th soldier in this battalion to lose his life. Oh, so I think about Duncan all the time. Mm. A great family. I talk to them as often as I can. They're in Colorado.
Mm. Oh, my. Let's go to Willie next from Steuben. Hi, Willie.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
And I think this is a great show. I'm glad to live in America, and I am glad to have served in the United States Marine Corps for 4 years active duty from 84 to 88. Those were pretty peaceful years. I did not have to go put my life on the line. I did not get sent anywhere and die if you have to. But I did take an oath, and I volunteered. And I went in when I was 18, and I was not a boy. And I just take a little exception to this constant characterization of, oh, these young people are dying, these boys are dying. Well, they chose to go do that, and they signed up, and they took the oath. And it becomes a thing that is bigger than yourself. And that is the desire, I believe, of these young men and women who join our military. They think they're going to do something good, and they believe in that. They're not conscripted. They're not compelled. They're not boy soldiers.
Yeah, I just use that phrase because I have our youngest son is almost 18, and to me, he's a boy. He's still forming his life.
I don't know, Willie. When you know, maybe you felt like a grown man at 18 when you went in. I think when you're 17 or 18 or 19, you know a lot of things, but you don't know a lot of things, you know, at 21 or 25 or 35.
Mm-hmm.
And for a lot, and whatever your reasons were for joining, Willie, I think you wouldn't disagree when I point out that there's a disproportionate share of a certain type of person who joins the military. And there are economic factors involved, and geographical factors too. It breaks down pretty interestingly. But you're right; they joined. They made the choice to join, and they were excited to go to Iraq. They had trained hard to be infantry soldiers to go in and fight, and nobody was nervous. I mean, of course they were nervous, but nobody didn't want to go to Iraq. Nobody didn't want to go to Baghdad. Still, if you ever want to see what a 19-year-old grown man is like, go to a memorial ceremony after a buddy of theirs has died, and they're not 19-year-old men at that point. They're 19-year-old young men, perhaps boy soldiers, when the emotions leaking out of them are quite profound to witness.
Thank you, Willie, for your call. Kathy is next from Oshkosh. Hi, Kathy.
Thank you for this opportunity. I have written 3 times to our local paper in an effort to get them to just print the casualty rates as they did in Vietnam in Milwaukee. They have yet to do so, and I do not understand how they can't at least raise our awareness in terms of that loss, much less what your guest has presented. And perhaps we would have those dreams, and that indeed would be a good thing.
Well, I'm not sure what's going on with your local paper at the Washington Post where I work. Every so often we'll do something called Faces of the Fallen, which is a couple of pages, a photo, the flag photo, and a brief description of everyone who is lost their lives since the last installment in the paper. And other papers, I think, do the same thing. There's also a website called iCasualties.org that that keeps a good running tally of some injuries, deaths especially, and links to descriptions. So it's another resource. It's not the same thing as opening up your local paper and seeing a listing, but at least there are some attempts out there to get people to keep paying attention.
Thanks for the call, Kathy. George from Milwaukee. Hi.
You know, we haven't. I haven't missed a peace rally since this war started in Iraq. And we're out usually on water in Wisconsin at least once a month. And it'd be interesting to have your guests comment on a few things, but certainly what is the attitude of these soldiers to those of us in the peace movement who try so hard to make sure that they weren't there in the first place and that they come back home safe? Secondly, the effectiveness of the surge. You said you were going to discuss that a little bit at the beginning of the program, and it certainly sounds like this unfortunate and poor soldier that lost all of his limbs and is comes right out of Johnny Got Your Gun. It was a very powerful movie back in 1971 with Timothy Bottoms.
Well, let me do the second part first. As far as the effectiveness of the surge, you know, maybe someday there will be, at least I hope there will be, a historian who can tease apart what made things better. Was it the surge? Was it the additional troops? Was it the Anbar Awakening out of western Iraq? Was it the al-Sadr ceasefire that calmed things down in some of the Shiite areas? Was it the fact that so many neighborhoods had been ethnically cleansed before the surge began? If it was all those things, in what proportions? At this point, I would be suspicious of anybody who could declare with absolute certainty that what we're seeing are solely the effects of the surge, because it's too soon to know. And when you ask about how the soldiers reacted to protesters, to peace protesters, I can tell you that the soldiers at times when there weren't rocket attacks or mortar attacks and they could kind of spend some leisure time at the dining facility. The dining facility had some big screen TVs. And they would sit there and eat and watch the news feed, whether it was CNN or MSNBC or Fox. And on would come pundits who had been in Iraq for 3 days, had kind of corkscrewed into Baghdad International, had gone around in a Humvee and seen a few sights, received a commemorative coin from a general. They corkscrew out. They went back to America. They went into the TV studio, and they said with all certainty, the surge has worked. Or they would say with all certainty, the surge is not working.
Mm-hmm.
And the soldiers in the midst of it would wonder, how in the world do they know? Because we don't know, and here we are fighting the thing. That's the thing that they wanted to talk about a lot. As far as the effects of a protest movement, you know, it's not something that occurred quite often in the midst of the war they were fighting. One time I can think of was in September 2007 when General Petraeus testified before Congress. And it was a big, big deal. And there were a lot of protests going on at that time. And the soldiers kind of watched some of the protesters, especially scenes from the ones in Washington marching toward the Capitol. And they weren't they were interested. They were intrigued. They weren't making fun of it in any way. But it's like everything that happened in Washington, it just felt so distant from the war they were fighting, because the war in Washington seemed to be about politics and strategy. And to them, the war was out on route predators. Three guys died today.
Yeah.
There was a profound disconnect.
I want to ask you to amplify on this. You were interviewed somewhere, and you said that what your time with them changed was your opinion of what it means to be a soldier. You simply had no idea until you saw it. And now I think I think that their conclusions are the ones that ought to be considered by people back here making decisions about, say, increasing the number of troops in Afghanistan. Their experiences should be part of the conversation about what happens next in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, I do think that. I think what it shouldn't be the factor in what generals or what President Obama or anyone decides about what's next in Afghanistan, but it needs to be part of the equation and not in some vague way, but in very, very specific terms. I would think that when President Obama, I guess a couple of weeks ago, went over to Dover Air Force Base in the middle of the night and spent 3 or 4 hours watching 18 flag-draped coffins go by, and also went on the plane a few times to escort a few of the coffins out and meet with families. That's whatever drove him to do that, whether it was a sincere intent or political intent. You can't help but spend those hours and be moved and have it affect you. So when I read in the paper that he had done that, I was glad for all the Duncan Crooksons and Adam Schumanns that he had those few hours to consider the far effects of what his policy will mean. And that's what I meant by what I had said earlier. What happened to these soldiers deserves to be part of any reasonable thinking and accounting of what war ought to be next.
Yeah. We'll take more calls in a moment. 800-486-8655 is our number. We go back to phone calls now, and Ron from Milwaukee is next. Hi, Ron.
Hi, Kathleen. Following up on that that last comment, I'm very concerned about the and would like to know what you know about the soldiers who have great doubts about, I don't know how many there are, and I don't know what percentage, about our being in the war, in Iraq, in Afghanistan. What is their point of view? What do you know about that, those who doubt the validity of the war?
Well, I think a soldier like any of us would like some clarity in what they're attempting to do on a particular day. Ron, it's worth pointing out that not everyone died in this battalion. Most didn't die. And not everyone got hurt. Most didn't get hurt. They all went in believing in this, I would say. And it was great to watch them go off. I mean, these are patriotic kids, and so what happened over their time in Baghdad is there was a kind of disillusionment. I guess that's a fair word to use. But the patriotism gave way to a thing at the end, where it felt cloudy to a lot of them. It felt uncertain, and more and more guys were saying, you know, it's an old canard with war, but it was true in this one too. The only reason I'm here is because of the guy next to me. It has nothing to do with mission, has nothing to do with what's going on in Washington. I'm here because of the guy next to me. And, you know, Adam Schumann was saying that at the end. Even as he had to go home, he just felt so guilty for leaving his guys behind. Not that he was walking away from a mission, but he was walking away from his soldiers.
Yeah. Here's an email from Cassie. My husband served in Iraq over 4 years ago and still suffers from anxiety and PTSD, often waking up dreaming he's getting shot at, and still will overreact to loud noises. The effects of the war will continue to haunt him for a long time, even though he was not physically wounded.
Yeah, well, I'm sure Kathy has learned the type of patience she didn't know going into this. And I've heard, obviously, there are a lot of stories out there, and I've heard similar things in the personal correspondence I've been getting from soldiers. And it makes sense to me. I mean, it certainly lingers in my mind. I was lucky because I got to come home and sort of wrestle with everything that happened by writing the book and summoning the war every day in a way to try to make sense out of what had happened in these 14 months. But, you know, I'm still a little jumpy. There are loud noises. There are certain sounds that when I hear them, even though I'm in Washington, there's something about the tone that sounds like the siren going off again in eastern Baghdad right before a rocket attack came. And if I'm experiencing that, I know for a fact the soldiers are, because they were in it longer and without relief. And so whatever Kathy's husband is going through, you know, multiply it by thousands and thousands and thousands of guys.
Yeah. Let's go next to Jan from North Freedom. Hi, Jan.
Hi, thank you. Quickly, if you could please, if your guest could please give some feedback on this situation. I have a grandson who's 22, I believe, 22, 23, enrolled at MATC, on a roll now with his education. Besides going to school, he also is working three jobs in order to finance it. Lately, when I talked to him, he's talking about joining the Army or the National Guard. Apparently, there are people recruiting him. Possibly a family member is encouraging him to pursue something like this, or a friend. He feels that he could get help with his schooling this way, that you know they help you with your school and financing your education, thinking about looking at this as a possibility to finance his education. He talked about being a cook in the service or perhaps driving an Humvee. Very optimistic. Could you please respond to that?
Oh, sure. Well, I think the more information he has to make this choice, the better. You know, it's an honorable thing to join the military. It's not like you're signing a death sentence. But it's tough. It's not a peacetime army, and there's a good chance that he'd be in for multiple deployments to very tough places. When I talk about the book, invariably someone will come up after and say, my son is thinking of joining. Do you think I should have him read the book? And I say, yeah, of course you should. I mean, this is an 18-year-old kid, a man. Let him have all the information available about what he's getting into so he can make a considered judgment and decision. And what's in the book, it's a sad story, but it's not necessarily what will happen, but it's a window into what could happen, and that ought to be part of his thinking as well.
Thanks, Jan. David from Germantown. Hi, David.
Hi. Why aren't there more scenes of the war on the news so we can really get a taste of what's happening? The closest I've seen is the HBO special, Hospital Baghdad or Baghdad Hospital, which just turned my stomach about what's going on over there. But I'd like to see some more scenes of what's really happening so that people get a taste of how horrible and terrible this thing is.
Well, I think you're going to see a lot more scenes coming out of Afghanistan in terms of a lot of the daily coverage. The war seems to have moved on as well. There's still great work being done in Iraq by some reporters, AP, the Washington Post reporters, New York Times reporters. The Post, I can tell you, even a time of some financial crisis at this paper, like so many papers, is spending millions of dollars a year to keep its bureau open in Baghdad and to send reporters out as far as they can across the country to try to chronicle what's going on in the hidden corners. And it's the same in Afghanistan. So there may not be as much coverage as you like, but I think there is coverage to be seen both on TV and in the papers that are big enough to be able to support having reporters in a place like Iraq or Afghanistan.
But it is true, I believe, David, that people have walked away from this war. There is very little television coverage. There's very little talk about it. The news coverage is centered, of course, on Afghanistan now and mm-hmm. more troops there. But we've kind of walked away from Iraq.
Yeah, I know. And I guess I take it a little bit personally because I haven't quite walked away from
it. No, well, you're bringing us back to it.
Well, there's still, 120,000 troops in country. And there are examples of rough things happening every day. And even if people don't want to be confronted anymore with scenes of what's going on in Iraq, there are hundreds of thousands of soldiers who have been there who are back now. And the problems they're contending with, again, not all, but some of them, they're beginning to filter out across the country into American courts, into American communities, into American help agencies. So for anyone to suggest the war is over, just go talk to Adam Schumann.
Yeah.
You'll know that the war is anything but over, and it's not going to be over. And the consequences are not only going to be something that he has to contend with, but they're going to be part of us for a very long time.
Yeah. We have about 45 seconds left, but we can handle this call. Dan from O'Connell Falls. Hi.
Hello, I was just wondering, oh, thank you for having me on the air, by the way, but I was just wondering, as time went on, did you find yourself, you know, becoming more jaded, or the other people around you just, you know, having that jaded feeling towards life?
No, not jaded. Again, as I think I said earlier, their sense of mission changed from an overall patriotism into a bit of disillusionment, in some cases, uncertainty. But they kept at it every day, and they're still at it right now.
David, thank you so much for being with us. Thank you for the book.
Well, thank you, Kathleen, very much.
David Finkel, the book is The Good Soldiers, has just been published and is one extraordinary read. Very sensitively written. Okay. That's it for... It takes your breath away. Show like that, doesn't it? It stays with you. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this program and to John Treader. Carmen's going to be retiring. I can't believe this. She's worked with us for so many years. And in case you want to send her a message, she booked this show. Thanks, Carmen. It has done a lot of work for many, many programs here, all the programs. If you want to send her... good wishes, you can go to our Facebook page and just send her good wishes. That would be nice. WPR.org. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network.